I saw, a month or two ago, in an Italian paper, that the Villa Cascana, in which I once stayed, had been pulled down, and that a manufactory of some sort was in process of erection on its site. There is therefore no longer any reason for refraining from writing of those things which I myself saw, or imagined I saw, in a certain room and on a certain landing of the villa in question, nor from mentioning the circumstances which followed, which may or may not, according to the opinion of the reader, throw some light on or be somehow connected with this experience. The Villa Cascana was, in all ways but one, a perfectly delightful house. Yet, if it were standing now, nothing in the world, I use the phrase in its literal sense, would induce me to set foot in it again, for I believe it to have been haunted in a very terrible and practical manner. Most ghosts, when all is said and done, do not do much harm. They may perhaps terrify, but the person whom they visit usually gets over their visitation. They may, on the other hand, be entirely friendly and beneficent. But the appearances in the Villa Cascana were not beneficent, and had they made their visit in a very slightly different manner, I do not suppose I should have got over it, any more than Arthur Inglis did. The house stood on an ilex-clad hill, not far from Sestri di Levante, on the Italian Riviera, looking out over the iridescent blues of that enchanted sea, while behind it rose the pale green chestnut woods that climb up the hillsides till they give place to the pines that, black in contrast with them, crown the slopes. All round it, the garden, in the luxuriance of mid-spring, bloomed and was fragrant, and the scent of magnolia and rose, borne on the salt freshness of the winds from the sea, flowed like a stream through the cool vaulted rooms. On the ground floor, a broad pillared loggia ran round three sides of the house, the top of which formed a balcony for certain rooms of the first floor. The main staircase, broad and of gray marble steps, led up from the hall to the landing outside these rooms, which were three in number, namely, two big sitting rooms and a bedroom arranged en suite. The latter was unoccupied. The sitting rooms were in use. From these, the main staircase was continued to the second floor, where were situated certain bedrooms, one of which I occupied, while from the other side of the first floor landing, some half dozen steps led to another suite of rooms, where, at the time I am speaking of, Arthur Inglis, the artist, had his bedroom and studio. Thus, the landing outside my bedroom at the top of the house commanded both the landing of the first floor and also the steps that led to Inglis's rooms. Jim Stanley and his wife, finally, whose guest I was, occupied rooms in another wing of the house, where were also the servants' quarters. I arrived just in time for lunch on a brilliant noon of mid-May. The garden was shouting with color and fragrance, and not less delightful after my broiling walk up from the marina should have been the coming from the reverberating heat and blaze of the day into the marble coolness of the villa. Only, the reader has my bare word for this and nothing more. The moment I set foot in the house, I felt that something was wrong. This feeling, I may say, was quite vague, though very strong, and I remember that when I saw letters waiting for me on the table in the hall, I felt certain that the explanation was here. I was convinced that there was bad news of some sort for me. Yet when I opened them, I found no such explanation of my premonition. My correspondence all reeked of prosperity. Yet this clear miscarriage of a presentiment did not dissipate my uneasiness. In that cool, fragrant house, there was something wrong. I am at pains to mention this, because, to the general view, it may explain that though I am, as a rule, so excellent a sleeper, that the extinction of my light on getting into bed is apparently contemporaneous with being called on the following morning, I slept very badly on my first night in the Villa Cascana. It may also explain the fact that when I did sleep, if it was indeed in sleep that I saw what I thought I saw, I dreamed in a very vivid and original manner. Original, that is to say, in the sense that something that, as far as I knew, had never previously entered into my consciousness, usurped it then. But since, in addition to this evil premonition, certain words and events occurring during the rest of the day might have suggested something of what I thought happened that night, it will be well to relate them. After lunch, then, I went round the house with Mrs. Stanley, and during our tour she referred, it is true, to the unoccupied bedroom on the first floor, which opened out of the room where we had lunched. "We left that unoccupied," she said, "because Jim and I have a charming bedroom and dressing room, as you saw, in the wing, and if we used it ourselves, we should have to turn the dining room into a dressing room and have our meals downstairs. As it is, however, we have our little flat there. Arthur Inglis has his little flat in the other passage, and I remembered, aren't I extraordinary, that you once said that the higher up you were in a house, the better you were pleased. So I put you at the top of the house, instead of giving you that room." It is true that a doubt, vague as my uneasy premonition, crossed my mind at this. I did not see why Mrs. Stanley should have explained all this, if there had not been more to explain. I allow, therefore, that the thought that there was something to explain about the unoccupied bedroom was momentarily present to my mind. The second thing that may have borne on my dream was this. At dinner, the conversation turned for a moment on ghosts. Inglis, with a certainty of conviction, expressed his belief that anybody who could possibly believe in the existence of supernatural phenomena was unworthy of the name of an ass. The subject instantly dropped. As far as I can recollect, nothing else occurred or was said that could bear on what follows. We all went to bed rather early, and I personally yawned my way upstairs, feeling hideously sleepy. My room was rather hot, and I threw all the windows wide, and from without poured in the white light of the moon and the love song of many nightingales. I undressed quickly and got into bed, but though I had felt so sleepy before, I now felt extremely wide awake. But I was quite content to be awake. I did not toss or turn. I felt perfectly happy listening to the song and seeing the light. Then, it is possible, I may have gone to sleep, and what follows may have been a dream. I thought, anyhow, that after a time the nightingales ceased singing and the moon sank. I thought also that if, for some unexplained reason, I was going to lie awake all night, I might as well read, and I remembered that I had left a book in which I was interested in the dining room on the first floor. So I got out of bed, lit a candle, and went downstairs. I went into the room, saw on a side table the book I had come to look for, and then, simultaneously, saw that the door into the unoccupied bedroom was open. A curious gray light, not of dawn nor of moonshine, came out of it, and I looked in. The bed stood just opposite the door, a big four-poster, hung with tapestry at the head. Then I saw that the grayish light of the bedroom came from the bed, or rather, from what was on the bed. For it was covered with great caterpillars, a foot or more in length, which crawled over it. They were faintly luminous, and it was the light from them that showed me the room. Instead of the sucker feet of ordinary caterpillars, they had rows of pincers like crabs, and they moved by grasping what they lay on with their pincers, and then sliding their bodies forward. In color, these dreadful insects were yellowish-gray, and they were covered with irregular lumps and swellings. There must have been hundreds of them, for they formed a sort of writhing, crawling pyramid on the bed. Occasionally one fell off onto the floor with a soft, fleshy thud, and though the floor was of hard concrete, it yielded to the pincher feet as if it had been putty, and crawling back, the caterpillar would mount onto the bed again to rejoin its fearful companions. They appeared to have no faces, so to speak, but at one end of them there was a mouth that opened sideways in respiration. Then, as I looked, it seemed to me as if they all suddenly became conscious of my presence. All the mouths, at any rate, were turned in my direction, and next moment they began dropping off the bed with those soft, fleshy thuds onto the floor and wriggling towards me. For one second, a paralysis as of a dream was on me, but the next I was running upstairs again to my room, and I remember feeling the cold of the marble steps on my bare feet. I rushed into my bedroom and slammed the door behind me, and then, I was certainly wide awake now, I found myself standing by my bed with the sweat of terror pouring from me. The noise of the banged door still rang in my ears. But, as would have been more usual, if this had been a mere nightmare, the terror that had been mine when I saw those foul beasts crawling about the bed or dropping softly onto the floor did not cease then. Awake now, if dreaming before, I did not at all recover from the horror of dream. It did not seem to me that I had dreamed. And until dawn, I sat or stood, not daring to lie down, thinking that every rustle or movement that I heard was the approach of the caterpillars. To them and the claws that bit into the cement, the wood of the door was child's play. Steel would not keep them out. But with the sweet and noble return of day, the horror vanished. The whisper of wind became benignant again. The nameless fear, whatever it was smoothed out and terrified me no longer. Dawn broke, hueless at first, then it grew dove-colored, then the flaming pageant of light spread over the sky. The admirable rule of the house was that everybody had breakfast where and when he pleased, and in consequence it was not till lunchtime that I met any of the other members of our party, since I had breakfast on my balcony and wrote letters and other things till lunch. In fact, I got down to that meal rather late, after the other three had begun. Between my knife and fork, there was a small pillbox of cardboard, and as I sat down, Inglis spoke. "Do look at that," he said, "since you are interested in natural history. I found it crawling on my counterpane last night, and I don't know what it is." I think that before I opened the pillbox, I expected something of the sort which I found in it. Inside it, anyhow, was a small caterpillar, grayish-yellow in color, with curious bumps and excrescences on its rings. It was extremely active, and hurried round the box, this way and that. Its feet were unlike the feet of any caterpillar I ever saw. They were like the pincers of a crab. I looked, and shut the lid down again. "No, I don't know it," I said, "but it looks rather unwholesome. What are you going to do with it?" "Oh, I shall keep it," said Inglis. "It has begun to spin. I want to see what sort of a moth it turns into." I opened the box again and saw that these hurrying movements were indeed the beginning of the spinning of the web of its cocoon. Then Inglis spoke again. "It's got funny feet, too," he said. "They're like crab's pincers. What's the Latin for crab? Oh yes, cancer. So in case it is unique, let's christen it Cancer Inglisensis." Then something happened in my brain, some momentary piecing together of all that I had seen or dreamed. Something in his words seemed to me to throw light on it all, and my own intense horror at the experience of the night before linked itself on to what he had just said. In effect, I took the box and threw it, caterpillar and all, out of the window. There was a gravel path just outside, and beyond it a fountain playing into a basin. The box fell onto the middle of this. Inglis laughed. "So the students of the occult don't like solid facts," he said. "My poor caterpillar." The talk went off again at once onto other subjects, and I have only given in detail, as they happened, these trivialities in order to be sure myself that I have recorded everything that could have borne on occult subjects or on the subject of caterpillars. But at the moment when I threw the pillbox into the fountain, I lost my head. My only excuse is that, as is probably plain, the tenant of it was, in miniature, exactly what I had seen crowded onto the bed in the unoccupied room. And though this translation of those phantoms into flesh and blood, or whatever it is that caterpillars are made of, ought perhaps to have relieved the horror of the night, as a matter of fact, it did nothing of the kind. It only made the crawling pyramid that covered the bed in the unoccupied room more hideously real. After lunch, we spent a lazy hour or two strolling about the garden or sitting in the loggia, and it must have been about 4 o'clock when Stanley and I started off to bathe, down the path that led by the fountain into which I had thrown the pillbox. The water was shallow and clear, and at the bottom of it I saw its white remains. The water had disintegrated the cardboard, and it had become no more than a few strips and shreds of sodden paper. The center of the fountain was a marble Italian Cupid, which squirted the water out of a wineskin held under its arm. And crawling up its leg was the caterpillar. Strange and scarcely credible as it seemed, It must have survived the falling to bits of its prison and made its way to shore, and there it was, out of arm's reach, weaving and waving this way and that as it evolved its cocoon. Then, as I looked at it, it seemed to me again that, like the caterpillar I had seen last night, it saw me, and breaking out of the threads that surrounded it, it crawled down the marble leg of the Cupid and began swimming like a snake across the water of the fountain towards me. It came with extraordinary speed. The fact of a caterpillar being able to swim was new to me, and in another moment was crawling up the marble lip of the basin. Just then, Inglis joined us. "Why, if it isn't old Cancer Inglisensis again," he said, catching sight of the beast. "What a tearing hurry it is in." We were standing side by side on the path, and when the caterpillar had advanced to within about a yard of us, it stopped and began waving again, as if in doubt as to the direction in which it should go. Then it appeared to make up its mind and crawled onto Inglis's shoe. "It likes me best," he said, "but I don't really know that I like it. And as it won't drown, I think perhaps..." He shook it off his shoe onto the gravel path and trod on it. All afternoon, the air got heavier and heavier with the sirocco that was without doubt coming up from the south, and that night again I went up to bed feeling very sleepy. But below my drowsiness, so to speak, there was the consciousness, stronger than before, that there was something wrong in the house, that something dangerous was close at hand. But I fell asleep at once, and, how long after I do not know, either woke or dreamed I awoke, feeling that I must get up at once, or I should be too late. Then, dreaming or awake, I lay and fought this fear, telling myself that I was but the prey of my own nerves, disordered by sirocco or whatnot, and at the same time quite clearly knowing in another part of my mind, so to speak, that every moment's delay added to the danger. At last, this second feeling became irresistible, and I put on coat and trousers and went out of my room onto the landing. And then I saw that I had already delayed too long, and that I was now too late. The whole of the landing of the first floor below was invisible under the swarm of caterpillars that crawled there. The folding doors into the sitting room from which opened the bedroom where I had seen them last night were shut, but they were squeezing through the cracks of it and dropping one by one through the keyhole, elongating themselves into mere string as they passed and growing fat and lumpy again on emerging. Some, as if exploring, were nosing about the steps into the passage at the end of which were Inglis's rooms. Others were crawling on the lowest steps of the staircase that led up to where I stood. The landing, however, was completely covered with them. I was cut off. And of the frozen horror that seized me when I saw that, I can give no idea in words. Then at last a general movement began to take place, and they grew thicker on the steps that led to Inglis's room. Gradually, like some hideous tide of flesh, they advanced along the passage, and I saw the foremost, visible by the pale gray luminousness that came from them, reach his door. Again and again I tried to shout and warn him, in terror all the time that they would turn at the sound of my voice and mount my stair instead. But for all my efforts, I felt that no sound came from my throat. They crawled along the hinge crack of his door, passing through as they had done before, and still I stood there, making impotent efforts to shout to him, to bid him escape while there was still time. At last, the passage was completely empty. They had all gone. And at that moment I was conscious, for the first time, of the cold of the marble landing on which I stood barefooted. The dawn was just beginning to break in the eastern sky. 6 months after, I met Mrs. Stanley in a country house in England. We talked on many subjects, and at last she said, "I don't think I have seen you since I got that dreadful news about Arthur Inglis a month ago." "I haven't heard," said I. "No? He's got cancer. They don't even advise an operation, for there is no hope of a cure. He is riddled with it, the doctors say." Now, during all these 6 months, I do not think a day had passed on which I had not had in my mind the dreams, or whatever you like to call them, which I had seen in the Villa Cascana. "It is awful, is it not?" she continued. "And I feel, I can't help feeling that he may have... caught it at the villa? I asked. She looked at me in blank surprise. Why did you say that? She asked. How did you know? Then she told me. In the unoccupied bedroom a year before, there had been a fatal case of cancer. She had, of course, taken the best advice and had been told that the utmost dictates of prudence would be obeyed so long as she did not put anybody to sleep in that room, which had also been thoroughly disinfected and newly whitewashed and painted. But... Stephen didn't see the moth at first. It was fairly well camouflaged against the bathroom wall. But once he saw it, he found that he couldn't unsee it. The thing was huge, easily bigger than his small spread palm, maybe even bigger than his father's hand. Its wings looked soft and furry, and Stephen wondered what it would be like to touch them, to rub the insectile hairs across his cheek. He shuddered with combined pleasure and revulsion at the thought. Its coloring was odd, and sort of ugly, Stephen had to admit. The wings were a particularly unappealing shade of yellow, broken up with asymmetrical streaks of dirty brown. Piss and shit, Stephen thought, and then giggled to himself. He glanced around to see if anyone had come in behind him, if anyone had heard him thinking the forbidden words. No one had. He stared up at the moth again. It made sense, though, he mused, once his boyish mirth had passed, for the moth to be those colors. He remembered seeing a program on TV about camouflage, about how animals evolve to blend into their environments. And this was a place for piss and shit, after all. This, the moth's environment. Stephen's eyes sparkled as he looked at it. The walls around the insect were a similar pissy yellow, as if painted by the very stench of the place, as if what went on in there had left its permanent mark. There were even streaks of a brownish something or other here and there on the walls. Maybe it was paint, maybe it was another thing. Stephen went a bit green thinking about that. He crept a little closer to the moth, but it didn't stir. It probably didn't feel threatened, since it was perched far up on the wall, close to the ceiling. Stephen didn't think he could reach it, even if he balanced himself on the toilet seat in the farthest stall and stretched his arm all the way out. Not that he had any intention of doing that, he had been in the John long enough as it was, and if he didn't hurry up, his father would be along, looking for him. Stephen's stomach clenched. He hated camping, and he hadn't wanted to come along on this trip, especially with only his father and his younger sister. It would have been better if Mom had come. Reluctantly, he took his eyes away from his new friend, the freakishly huge piss-and-shit moth, and went about the business he'd tramped up here for. There was one high window across the length of the back wall, no glass, just a rectangle cut neatly out of the concrete. Stephen could see the sunlight filtering through the treetops and hear the twittering of birds and the faraway sounds of children laughing, splashing around in the springs a short distance away. He finished peeing and pulled his trunks back up, glancing sideways up at the moth as he did so. It hadn't moved. He wondered how long it had been sitting there. He had just washed his hands and was drying them on his shorts because the paper towel dispenser was empty, when he heard footsteps crunching in the fallen leaves outside. His heart lurched in his chest and he turned, coiling the muscles in his legs to prepare for a sprint. But then a stranger walked in, an old man with a fringe of white hair. The man smiled absently at him and disappeared into one of the stalls. Stephen's held breath stuttered out like a dying boat motor. With one last look at the gigantic insect, he ducked out of the bathroom and began trotting down the rough dirt path that led back to the campgrounds in the springs. It was late August, and the sun hammered down like a judgment, trying to boil everything upon the surface of the earth. Stephen wiped sweat from his face with the back of his hand, thinking of how good the cool, clear water would feel on his skin. He planned to run the last 20 feet of the path and plunge into the water all at once, making a massive splash, relishing the blue ice enveloping him utterly and cradling him. He passed their campsite with its small red dome of a tent, the remnants of a fire, wet towels slung over low branches. Both his father and Tricia were down at the water. Most everyone was. Almost all of the campsites looked deserted. The springs loomed ahead, the still water seeming to warp and shimmer in the relentless heat. People dotted the small crescent of beach that hugged the shore. Kids ran back and forth, couples languished on blankets, their bodies crimson and sizzling. Stephen could make out the back of his father's head, the greasy dark hair that always looked scraggly at the back, flopping over his collar.
Stephen remembered that his mother always complained about how fast his father's hair grew, how often he had to have it cut. When she did, his father would usually just tell her to shut her mouth. Stephen wondered why she kept bringing it up. Tricia was playing at the shoreline, digging in the sugary sand with her little green shovel. She didn't know how to swim yet. As Stephen watched, the little girl grew tired of digging and began slapping the shovel on the surface of the water, making crystal droplets fly in all directions. The sound it made delighted her so much that she squealed loudly in time with the rhythmic slaps. Squeal, blat, squeal, blat. After a few moments, Stephen heard his father's voice roaring, "God damn it, Tricia, stop that noise or I'll beat your ass." Tricia stopped, and even from this distance, Stephen could see the kid's bottom lip beginning to tremble. Stephen sent a mental stream of hate at the back of his father's head, so white-hot and tangible that he was surprised that his father didn't feel it, didn't turn around and fix him with those steel-cold eyes. Stephen sauntered down to the beach, forgetting his earlier plan to run and jump into the water. He passed his father's chair and nodded in acknowledgement. His father simply looked at him, brows knitted in a stern V. Tricia looked up at her older brother when he approached and smiled her sunny smile at him. She wasn't dark like Stephen and his father, but pale, fragile, cherubic. She had their mother's curly blonde hair and wide, innocent blue eyes, which were now ringed with red. Stephen bent down and kissed the top of her head. "Having fun, kiddo?" he asked. She goggled at him, waving the shovel around, and said something that sounded like, "Hello, Stevie," then laughed at her own mangling of the words. Stephen laughed too, the good laughter, like a shared secret. "I'm going in the water, so just stay here near Daddy," he told her, and she stared at him, eyes like polished marbles. He didn't know if she understood, but she didn't follow him as he waded into the shallow part of the spring. Stephen walked farther out, the sand like velvet under his toes, except where the occasional shell fragment would rear up out of the depths and bite with serrated edges. Once his feet couldn't touch the bottom anymore, he stretched himself out and began to glide through the water, fancying himself a dolphin or an otter, wicking the droplets from his body as he dove down, came back up, dove down again. He opened his eyes underwater and looked all around, his cheeks puffed out with trapped air, bubbles leaking from his lips, tickling them. Off to the right and in front of him was a dark forest of waving seaweed, slick with furry algae. The fur reminded him of the moth's wings, and with a delicious anticipation, he thought of going back into the bathroom later tonight, perhaps after his father was asleep, to see if the moth was still there. Maybe he'd even see it out hunting for food, its piss-and-shit-colored wings whirring in the humid August night, as it descended like an angel of death upon its prey. Stephen swam off to the left, towards the boil, where the pleasantly warm water erupted from deep in the earth. He went briefly to the surface to take a breath, then plunged back down again, chasing after the tiny silver fish that darted in formation through the lazy green stalks at the bottom. There were divers down in the boil, and the rocks down there glittered like newly fallen snowbanks against the sleek black of their wetsuits. Stephen watched them for a moment and then popped back up to the surface, flicking his longish black hair away from his face. It was so hot that he could almost feel himself withering. He lowered himself into the water until only the top of his head above his nose was visible, then paddled with his arms and legs, making circles so that the currents of the warmish water eddied around him, buoying him up. He peered down at his distorted forearms through the surface of the water, amused by the fragmented funhouse effect. The slant of sunlight through the ripples made his skin appear blue, like the fabulous sheen of a mermaid in one of his storybooks at home. "I'm camouflaged," he thought, waving his arms back and forth, enjoying the weight of the water as he pushed through it. "No one can see me. No one can get me. I can swoop down on those insects with my enormous blue wings and they'll never see me coming." He wasn't sure how long he floated there, staring at his arms. He felt his legs beginning to get heavy and sore, and it became harder to keep his nose above the surface. The light seemed different, the sun lower in the sky, its glare not so punishing. Stephen dipped his head back under, then came up, spluttering a little, smoothing his hair back again. The water left a moldy green taste in his mouth. His fingers were all pruney, like when he had been in the bathtub too long. He swam back toward the shore, using long, lithe strokes. When he got near enough, he felt for the sandy bottom with his feet and walked the rest of the way up. His father was still in his chair, but now he was snoring, with his brows knitted in their perpetual expression of displeasure. Tricia was sleeping too, fitfully, her shovel clutched in her tiny hand. Stephen noted that her cheeks and nose were red with sunburn, and he glared at his snoring father, annoyed that he hadn't thought to put sunscreen on the child. People were starting to drift back to their campsites, carrying their lounge chairs and coolers, shoulders slumped and brown, hair bedraggled. It was almost supper time, and everyone would be starting up the fires and grills soon, sending the wonderful summery smells of burgers and hot dogs and steak spiraling into the twilight. Stephen realized he was hungry. He considered waking his father, but was reluctant to do so. With a sigh, he again wished his mother were here to take care of these things. She would wake him up, even if he yelled at her or slapped her across the mouth for doing it. Stephen turned and looked out across the spring. The water was darkening, taking on a deeper blue color that would soon become purple, then black as the night fell across it. He remembered the look of his arms under the water, part of the water, the blue of his skin and the blue of the water. Blue and blue, yellow and yellow, brown and brown. Maybe his father didn't wake up because Stephen wasn't even there. He was camouflaged against the water, invisible. With a shrug, he began walking up the dirt path toward the campgrounds. His bare feet were wrinkly and sensitive from their long soak, and every rock and shell that they encountered made Stephen wince. He could hear people's voices, laughter, and snatches of songs from someone's radio. The trees around him stretched up to forever, protecting him from the eye of the fading sun. He flitted among the trees, pretending he was flapping his soft furry wings, pretending they were the same color as the tree trunks. No one else was on the path around him. They were all up ahead or still on the beach. They wouldn't have been able to see him anyway. The campsite looked the same as it had before, with the red tent and the damp towels on the branches. There was activity now, though, in the other campsites that were just visible through the trees. He could see the orange glow from the fires, smiling faces lit by the flames. He could smell food cooking, hear the clink of glass and cutlery. His stomach rumbled. Stephen crawled through the tent flap on his hands and knees, poking around in his sleeping bag for his jeans and t-shirt. He found some clean underwear in his backpack and rolled all the clothes up into a bundle that he stuck under his arm. It wasn't dark enough yet to need the flashlight. He backed out of the tent and took his bundle up the path toward the bathroom. The air seemed to be coming alive with the sound of buzzing and clicking, tiny insects and creatures waking from their daylight slumbers and taking wing to eat or be eaten. Every night was a gamble. The bathroom was empty when he reached it, for which he was grateful. The light over the sink was dirty and flickered intermittently, as if threatening to give up altogether. But the glassless window gave enough light to see by, sunset light, orange and pink and lavender. His bundle of clothes still in his arms, Stephen glanced up to the ceiling near the farthest stall. The moth was still there, in the exact same place it had been earlier in the afternoon. It seemed bigger, but Stephen thought that was probably his imagination. Its piss-yellow wings lay flat against the piss-yellow wall, looking as soft as goose down. Stephen hurried out of his wet swimsuit and into his dry clothes, trying not to take his eyes off the moth. It sat, stoic, even its antennae motionless. Stephen thought for a second that it might be dead, and the idea sent a cold chill up his spine, despite the smothering heat. But just then, the moth flexed its great wings, like a person stretching after a long, restoring sleep. Stephen's whole body spasmed in surprise, and his damp shorts fell with a muffled splat at his feet. He stared gape-mouthed as the moth took flight, first fluttering over to investigate the dingy light fixture, then hovering at the window as though peering out into the night, searching for something or someone. Stephen swore that he could feel the displaced air from the flap of the moth's wings. It caressed his face like his mother's breath. It seemed as though an eternity passed while the moth fluttered there, back and forth along the length of the window as though patrolling the grounds. Stephen stood rooted to the spot, his trunks cold on his toes. Suddenly, the moth dived away from the window and resumed its post on the wall, laying its wings flat against the yellow paint again. Stephen wondered what it had seen, friend or foe, but then his question was answered when a small mosquito cruised into the bathroom through the rectangular gap, twizzing about in that ass-hanging way that mosquitoes had, forever on the lookout for blood. Stephen waved it away when it came near his face, and, as if sensing the snub, the mosquito lifted its ungainly body toward the ceiling, toward where the moth lay hidden in plain sight against the wall. It happened so fast that Stephen wasn't sure he had seen it. When the mosquito came within a few inches of the monstrous moth, the great yellow and brown wings flapped once, propelling the giant insect's body away from the wall, and like a hawk dropping into a field, scooping up a terrified mouse or rabbit and carrying it kicking and shrieking through the sky in its scaly claws, the moth descended on the mosquito, its shadow falling across the much smaller insect like a kite's shadow across the ground. And then the mosquito was simply gone, its days of careless vampirism ended in one fraction of a second. Apparently sated, the moth settled back into its place among the piss and shit stains on the wall. Stephen felt immobilized by the scene, still not believing what his eyes had shown him. The ferocity of nature played out right here in some stinking bathroom in some filthy campground somewhere out in the fetid, swampy wilderness. For a moment it overwhelmed him, the quickness with which life could be snuffed out, the lack of remorse felt by the snuffer afterward. Predator and prey, eat or be eaten. He looked up at the moth with something like awe. Only the slight darkening at the edges of its wings betrayed its position on the wall. The sky outside the window had grown dark, and stars had begun to appear between the branches. Finally shaking himself, breaking the spell, Stephen bent and picked up his shorts from the floor. They were mostly dry now. He wondered if his father and Tricia had come back from the beach yet, or if they were even now snoring under the canopy of stars as the warm water bubbled and lapped before them, boiling up from someplace down in the core of the earth, somewhere devils lived. It didn't matter, Stephen supposed. He was camouflaged. They wouldn't be able to see him. Waving goodbye to his moth, which looked even bigger now than it had when he'd first come in, Stephen went out into the night, listening to the chirp of frogs and crickets, wondering how many of them would live to see the dawn. The smell of smoke and cooking meat was very strong, but he didn't notice it so much now. He wasn't really that hungry anymore. In the wan light from the faraway fires and from the lamps along the path, he began looking for a stick or a heavy branch. His father was at the campsite, sitting in his chair with his back to the path. The glow from the fire in front of him gave him a weird reddish-orange aura, a neon outline. Stephen could see from the movement of the tent that Tricia was inside it, playing. He didn't bother about the noise his feet were making on the leaves and pine needles. He was camouflaged. The black of the tree trunks, the red of the tent fabric, the orange of the flames, the gray of the smoke. No one could see him as he swooped down on his prey, invisible, ghostly death. His father didn't even turn around as Stephen swung the branch. Stephanie Guthrie stood in the center of the pile of blood-soaked bodies, her arms outstretched, her face a blank mask. Children pointed and screamed, animals paced in their cages. Zoo employees gaped like statues, unable to believe what they had just seen. Soon enough, the police came to quell the panic, and then an ambulance came and bundled the woman inside. "I haven't been able to get a single word out of her," said Teresa Hill, the police psychologist. "Looks like partial catatonia." Vic Unger, the lead investigator on what was sure to be the most bizarre case the city had ever seen, made a disgusted sound. "Typical. And wait till you hear what we got back from the lab guys." "What's that?" The halls were nearly empty in this ward, and Teresa's voice echoed like a snatch of memory. "Cause of death for all 15 people at the zoo," Vic said, "was evidently a mass poisoning. In other words, they were gassed." Teresa raised her eyebrows at him. "Terrorists?" Vic shrugged. "That's why we need to get a story out of the sole survivor in there." He scratched distractedly at his 3 days' growth of beard. "She doesn't strike me as the terrorist type, I gotta say." "No. Maybe the poison came from somewhere else, and Miss Guthrie was the only one lucky enough to survive it." "Could be, although witnesses say the people around her dropped dead as soon as she raised her arms, like the two events were related. Have you done any scans on her or anything? Checked her for brain damage?" "Yes, looks like nothing out of the ordinary so far." "Damn." Vic was a handsome man, only in his mid-30s, but already cultivating a look of hangdog cynicism that Teresa found amusing. They had reached the end of the hall and the locked room where Stephanie Guthrie was being held for observation. Teresa produced a set of keys from the pocket of her coat and opened the door. Stephanie was sitting rigidly in the chamber's only chair, her hands resting stiffly on her lap. She didn't look up as Teresa and Vic entered, but kept her gaze fixed on a spot just below eye level. A very long moment passed before she even blinked. "Hello there, Miss Guthrie." Teresa stood before the woman, her arms crossed. "How are we doing today?" Stephanie, of course, did not answer. "The investigator is here, Miss Guthrie," Teresa continued, gesturing to Vic, who was standing slightly behind and to the left of her. "He'd really like to get to the bottom of what happened at the zoo on Saturday. Do you think you'll be able to cooperate?" More silence, in which Stephanie's chest barely rose and fell with her breathing. Vic stepped forward at Teresa's urging. "I'm Vic Unger, Miss Guthrie," he said. "I'd like to help you, but to do that, I need to ask you some questions. Is that all right?" Another blink, another breath. Vic wasn't in the mood for this. His impatience was one of his few negative attributes. Can't you just hypnotize her or something? He asked. Teresa stared down at the top of Stephanie's head. That may become necessary, although I have to tell you ahead of time that hypnosis is sometimes not a very effective psychiatric tool. We generally only use it as a last resort. Well, can you get started on all the other resorts? I'd really like to figure out what the hell is going on here. As would we all, Mr. Unger, Teresa smiled at him. But cases like this take time. I'm sure you understand. Vic nodded. He did understand, but he didn't like it. The next day, driving up the interstate, Vic ran the facts of the case through his mind again, hoping to stumble upon a detail he'd missed the first few times. Last Saturday, at approximately 2:15 p.m. at the Langford County Zoo, 32-year-old Stephanie Guthrie had been strolling through the butterfly garden in the company of her 36-year-old fiancé, Ray Framington. According to witnesses, the few who were left alive, that is, they had been holding hands, and Stephanie had been smiling. Then suddenly, things had taken a macabre turn. In an instant, the woman had gone white, tilting her head slightly upwards as if she had just heard something that shocked her beyond her capacity to reason. Her eyes apparently glazed over, and even though Ray Framington had shaken her, trying to discern the problem, she had acted as though he wasn't even there. Then, witnesses agreed, she had slowly begun to raise her arms until they were even with her shoulders. At the moment when she opened her hands, spreading her fingers to their farthest extremes, the 15 people closest to her, including her fiancé, had simultaneously begun to bleed from every orifice, and after an agonizing moment of this horrifying spectacle, all 15 had dropped dead to the concrete like sacks of grain. As this was happening, Stephanie Guthrie stood as still as marble in the center of the action, her outstretched hands like white wings, her expression as lifeless as that of a china doll. When the police and then the ambulance had come, she had said nothing, reacted to nothing. The EMTs who strapped her onto the gurney said that she was completely docile, but also entirely lacking in humanity, like an empty husk. Since then, her condition had not changed. Vic took a swig of black coffee from his thermos, then settled it back into the fork of his crotch. His dark mood was getting darker by the minute. He thought of Dr. Hill's mention of terrorists. That had been his first thought, too, but something about the situation didn't sit right. Besides that, a search of Stephanie Guthrie's person had turned up nothing resembling a container in which the toxin could have been carried, and even her skin had only shown trace amounts of the chemical that had killed the others. It was all very odd. Whatever direction the case was taking, the department was on his ass to put it to bed as quickly as possible, and to that end he was skipping lunch and driving up to Hastings to interview Miss Guthrie's parents. He hoped they could give him some insight into her history, her personality. From long experience, though, he knew this wasn't likely. He sighed and turned off the highway. Vic parked in front of a modest brick townhouse and slid out of the car. He'd called the Guthries yesterday to set up the meeting, and now as he walked up the driveway, he noticed the curtain twitching as someone peered out at him. He pretended he hadn't seen. His knock was answered by a rail-thin man in his mid-60s, clean-shaven with a slick bald head. His eyes were absinthe green, sharp and wary. Come in, Inspector Unger, was it? Call me Vic, Mr. Guthrie, thanks. Vic passed over the threshold and immediately spotted Mrs. Guthrie, who stood nervously at the end of the hall. She was also in her 60s, still fairly youthful and fit, though the few lines on her face appeared deep with worry. At Mr. Guthrie's invitation, Vic took a seat in the living room, choosing a worn upholstered chair near the unlit fireplace. He noticed a framed photograph of Stephanie on the mantle, and for a moment he marveled at the difference between the cheerful girl in the picture and the sullen zombie he'd seen back at the hospital. Mrs. Guthrie offered tea, which Vic politely refused. He waited until the couple had settled themselves on the matching sofa across from him, and then he got straight to the point. Let me just say that I want nothing more than to see that Stephanie gets the help she needs, Mr. and Mrs. Guthrie, he began. As I'm sure you're aware, the situation is very grave. 15 people are dead, and it appears that Stephanie may somehow be involved, as either a victim or a perpetrator. As I told you on the phone, she is refusing or unable to speak, so anything you can tell me would be greatly appreciated. He pulled a tiny tape recorder from his jacket pocket. May I? The couple murmured assent, and he switched it on. Mrs. Guthrie's lower lip was trembling. I just don't understand how any of this could have happened, she said. Stephanie never hurt anyone. And she would never do anything to hurt Ray. She adored him. Mr. Guthrie was nodding in agreement. Yes, there must be some mistake. I'm sure she was just the victim of a horrible attack, or perhaps a freak accident. That's what we're hoping to find out, Vic said with a tight smile. Please forgive me, but I have to ask some of these questions. Now, about Ray, they were engaged, correct?
Yes.
Had they been having any problems, though? Arguments? Had her behavior seemed any different recently? Mr. Guthrie was shaking his head before Vic had even finished speaking. We just saw the both of them on Friday night. They came over for dinner. Nothing was wrong. They were happy, laughing, talking about the wedding plans. I just can't believe Stephanie would have anything to do with anything so horrible, Mrs. Guthrie said. Her eyes were glistening, but she spoke firmly. The poor dear. Especially after... Yvonne, Mr. Guthrie bellowed. Vic fixed each of them with a hard stare. Especially after what?
Nothing, Inspector, said Mr. Guthrie. My wife was just going to say, especially after we had just seen her the day before.
He shot Yvonne a warning look that he probably thought Vic didn't notice.
George.
She reached out and touched the back of his hand. Vic's impatience was beginning to flare up again. It won't help your daughter's case if you keep information from me, he said, trying to tone down the irritation in his voice.
She's not our daughter, Mrs. Guthrie said with a defiant glance toward her husband. I thought you might have found that out by now.
Yvonne, I told you. Vic put up his hand to silence Mr. Guthrie, who was clearly approaching a meltdown. Let your wife talk, sir.
He doesn't like to talk about it, said Mrs. Guthrie, patting her husband's hand again. It was his brother and sister-in-law, you know.
Mr. Guthrie looked ready to explode, but Vic preempted him with a calming gesture. Go on, Mrs. Guthrie.
It was such a long time ago. Stephanie was only about 10 at the time, Yvonne said. A very bright child she was. We didn't see her often back then, you understand. Her parents, that's George's brother and sister-in-law, lived in Rosemere, about 90 miles north of here. But we saw them on holidays, of course.
Vic wondered if this story would be going anywhere relevant, but he leaned forward in his seat, silently encouraging her to continue.
Well, it happened at Stephanie's school, Yvonne said. She glanced over at George, who had covered his face with his hands. It was one of those open house nights, you know, where the parents come to meet the teachers and so on. Do you have any children, Inspector?
Vic did, a baby son, but he shook his head no. He didn't want Mrs. Guthrie getting sidetracked.
Well, it was the funniest thing, Yvonne continued, to Vic's relief. Not funny, of course, but strange. I don't think anyone ever figured out exactly what happened. It was all so sudden. One minute there were kids and parents milling around the classroom, looking at all the projects the children had made. And then the next minute,
Mrs. Guthrie waved her hand vaguely in the air. Her bottom lip was trembling again.
I wasn't there, you understand, she said, her voice going hoarse, but I heard all about it. The paper said there was blood everywhere, covering everything, and all those poor little children.
The tears finally came, and Yvonne pressed her hands to her lips, an indication that she could not continue.
Vic looked to Mr. Guthrie, who looked haggardly back at him.
What happened? Vic asked.
They all died. What do you think happened? George rasped. My brother and sister-in-law, some other parents, teachers, a bunch of kids, almost everyone in the room, as a matter of fact. Stephanie and one other person were the only ones who survived.
But what killed them? Vic urged, exasperated. Was it a shooting?
Mrs. Guthrie had recovered enough to speak again. I told you they didn't know what it was. Everyone just dropped dead, near as I can figure from the news stories. No one was shot, they were sure of that, but...
She trailed off, shrugging. I guess they didn't have all the fancy forensic science they have nowadays. Anyway, it was in all the papers back then. The Rosemere Gazette, a couple of others. She sniffed and wiped at her nose primly with a handkerchief she had produced from her pocket.
Vic made a mental note to check the archives for news stories about the deaths. He didn't remember hearing about it at the time, but he hadn't been much older than Stephanie then, and he doubted that any news story, no matter how bizarre, would have made its way into his teenage psyche all those years ago.
Was Stephanie questioned after all this happened? He asked.
Mr. and Mrs. Guthrie looked at each other. There was a long pause, then Yvonne finally said, she was never the same afterwards. Her voice was so soft that Vic had to lean further forward to hear her. She just kind of vanished into herself. Not surprising, I suppose, after such a trauma. George and I got custody. We were the closest relatives, you know, and we were happy to do it. But we couldn't reach the girl. She had to be hospitalized for a while.
Yvonne looked as though she might be on the verge of losing it again, but she clenched her jaw and held herself together.
How long was she hospitalized, Mrs. Guthrie? Vic had lowered his voice to match hers.
Oh, almost 2 years, I think it was.
She sounded almost apologetic, as though the girl's illness was a personal failing. I hated to see her in there, I really did, but, well, what else could we do? They did help her in that hospital, right enough, Mr. Guthrie added. Stephanie was never the same as before, but once she came out of there, she was much better. Not like she was, but still okay. Now it looked as though George might break down crying again. Vic thought he had caused the couple enough anguish for one day, so he switched off the recorder, replaced it in his pocket, and stood to go. "Thanks very much, Mr. and Mrs. Guthrie," he said, reaching out to shake their hands. "I'll be in touch, and if you think of anything more, give me a call." "We certainly will." Vic left the pair to their heartbreak and made his way back to his car, where he finished off the thermos of now lukewarm coffee. His earlier hesitancy, it seemed, had been wrong. He had obtained quite a bit of interesting information from Stephanie's adoptive parents. And now it seemed like the reticent Miss Guthrie wasn't quite as above suspicion as she had first appeared. Teresa Hill locked her office door behind her, then retraced her well-worn steps down the hall to Stephanie Guthrie's room. It had been 4 days since the incident, and very little progress had been made. The woman was easily the most difficult case she'd ever run across, and as such was maddeningly intriguing. Stephanie had not moved during Teresa's absence. The doctor fetched a chair from an adjacent room and placed it a few feet from Stephanie, then closed the door. Perhaps hypnosis was the only way to reach the patient, Dr. Hill mused. Certainly nothing else had worked. Teresa had tried cajoling and threatening, withholding food, appealing to Stephanie's love for her family and her dead fiancé. The woman had sat through it all, stoic, emotionless. She wasn't completely out of it, Teresa knew. She had been eating a little and could be counted upon to get up and use the bathroom when necessary. But beyond that, she was a shell of a person, an automaton. Teresa started today's session as she had begun the others, talking to Stephanie in low tones, addressing her frequently by name in order to place focus on her core identity. As with all the other times, Stephanie did not react, not even to make fleeting eye contact with the doctor. After about 15 minutes of this, Teresa sighed and stopped talking. Clearly, it was time for a different approach, one she had been putting off for days. She reached into the pocket of her coat and drew out the small metronome she had brought from her office. She got up and placed it on the seat of her chair. She turned it on, and its winking silver needle began to tick back and forth, with a sound like a wooden cane tapping on pavement. "I don't know if you can hear me or understand me, Stephanie," said Dr. Hill, standing off to the side with her hands clasped behind her back. "But if you can, I want you to look at the object in front of you, concentrate on it very hard, and ignore everything else but it and the sound of my voice." Teresa had no idea whether Stephanie was complying or not, since her blank expression did not change. She pressed on. "Good. Just keep looking at it, focusing on the needle going back and forth, back and forth." Again, there was no discernible reaction, but Teresa continued on, allowing her voice to become softer and softer until it was a pleasant drone in the drab room. At last she said, "Now, Stephanie, I want you to close your eyes." For a long moment, nothing happened, and Teresa's hopes began to fade. Perhaps they would never be able to reach the woman. Perhaps the bizarre deaths at the zoo would remain forever unsolved. Then Stephanie's eyes fluttered closed. Teresa almost leaped for joy, but managed to keep her voice level, even as her heart hammered against her ribcage. "Very good, Stephanie. Now I want you to go back to last Saturday, the day you and Ray went to the zoo. Do you remember?" Stephanie didn't answer, but her brow furrowed as though she'd just heard some troubling news. Teresa was so elated to see a change in expression that she immediately moved on to the next question. "What happened that day, Stephanie? Can you tell me?" The patient's frown deepened, and her eyelids began to twitch. Teresa thought she saw the woman shake her head ever so slightly, but it might have been wishful thinking. "Can you tell me what happened, Stephanie?" Dr. Hill persisted, trying mightily to keep from badgering her. "You were walking along with Ray, weren't you? There were some other people around. And then what?" Two tears squeezed from beneath Stephanie's closed lids and trickled down her cheeks. Her face was a mask of horror and sorrow, and Teresa considered waking her up right then. But at that moment, Stephanie began to move. Her arms, which had been dangling loosely by her sides, started to rise, almost as though they were attached to a puppeteer's strings. Stephanie's eyes remained closed, but her face contorted, seemingly fighting against the actions of the rest of her body. Her arms were now outstretched, level with her shoulders, and as Teresa watched, the woman unfurled her fingers like flower petals and spread them wide. The doctor opened her mouth to ask what she was doing, but then Stephanie's eyes flew open and her gaze fixed fully on Teresa, the zombie stare now replaced by a look of frightening, hyper-aware intensity. The doctor backed up a step. "The voice," said Stephanie, the words little more than a creak of muscles long unused. Dr. Hill was so shocked that the patient had spoken that she stumbled over the next question and had to repeat it. "Whose voice, Stephanie?" she asked, trying to maintain contact with that unsettling stare. "What did it say?" Stephanie's eyes widened, becoming round black holes in the midst of her ghostly visage. There was a sound from behind, but Teresa ignored it, intent upon her patient's words. "Lepidoptera," Stephanie said, and then her entire body seemed to collapse in on itself, her arms dropping back to her sides, her head falling forward until her chin rested on her chest. Blood came, first in a trickle and then in a torrent. Frantically, Teresa clapped her hands, attempting to wake the patient from the hypnotic trance, but the sharp sounds of her palms smacking together had no effect, other than producing a flat echo against the gray concrete walls. Vic stomped on the gas, urging the car to go faster, even though he was already exceeding the speed limit by a considerable margin. He hoped to Christ his hunch was wrong, but a sick feeling in the pit of his stomach suggested it wasn't. In fact, if Dr. Hill had gone ahead with the planned hypnosis, then it was probably already too late. After leaving the Guthries the day before yesterday, Vic had gone straight to the Rosemere Library and spent the better part of the afternoon examining the newspaper archives on microfilm. And there, just as Mrs. Guthrie had stated, was the entire unbelievable story, laid out in all its puzzling detail, though Stephanie, being a minor, was not mentioned by name. Police at the time had been mystified, and even though Vic had scoured the later records hoping for some follow-up, he had found nothing further, other than a short article a few months after the event which speculated that the deaths had been caused by some freak chemical seepage into the classroom, since the victims had apparently all succumbed to some unknown poisonous fumes. Just like the 15 people at the zoo, Vic had thought grimly. Only one other person had survived the accident 12 years before, and that was a young teacher by the name of Bill Travers. Vic had spent the previous day tracking the man down, only to find out that he had died in an institution, having been in a near-comatose state for nearly 10 years following the occurrence at the school open house. And after speaking to one of the older nurses who still worked at the hospital where Travers had died, Vic discovered something else, that when a doctor had attempted hypnosis in order to reach the poor man, Travers had ended up dead, the doctor catatonic. Postmortem examination of Mr. Travers had revealed that his death was caused by the same mysterious chemical that had killed the parents and children in the classroom, and the same one, Vic knew, that had killed the 15 people at the zoo last week. He'd had a report back from the lab boys on that, too. They had no idea what the substance was, other than that it was sort of like a pheromone, but deadly poisonous. "Yeah, tell me something I don't know," Vic had said sardonically. But there was a minor detail that nagged at Vic. The nurse at the institution where Travers had breathed his last had supplied him with a grainy black-and-white videotape of the hypnosis session where Travers had died. The similarity with Stephanie's case was chilling, as the man sat very still in his chair, seemingly insensate, as the doctor stood over him, intoning a list of questions that was meant to draw him out of his traumatized state. But suddenly the man's eyes had opened, his face had wrenched apart in a silent scream, and he had uttered a single word, Lepidoptera. The tape stopped just as his lifeless body slithered to the floor. Vic blew through a yellow light that turned red the second he passed under it. He didn't understand exactly what the mechanisms behind all this were, but the outcome seemed abundantly clear. Something was causing these people to transform from normal functioning human beings into what? Was it some kind of killer virus triggered by environmental factors, or even by some internal apparatus that lay dormant in the body until a particular moment caused it to flower? Vic didn't know, but he did know that both Stephanie Guthrie and Teresa Hill were in horrible danger. Even though he had abandoned the idea of God long ago, he began reciting a litany in his head, something like a prayer, though to who or what he was praying he couldn't have said. Please let it not be too late. Please let it not be too late. After what seemed like hours of driving, the unobtrusive sign identifying the Mayflower Psychiatric Hospital loomed through his windshield. He turned the car without slowing down, feeling two tires leave the ground, and then tore down the long tree-lined road that led to the parking lot. He pulled abruptly to the curb and leaped from the car, leaving the door wide open and the keys dangling in the ignition. Doctors and nurses turned to stare at him as he belted down the halls, flashing his badge at anyone who looked as though they may try to stop him, squeezing through the digitally locked doors the second the shocked guards had opened them. His shoes squeaked on the linoleum, and his lungs were filled with the mingled odors of urine and sweat and formaldehyde. He headed first for Dr. Hill's office, but saw immediately that she was not there. His heart sinking, he continued running down the endless corridors, deeper into the bowels of the hospital. At last he arrived at Stephanie Guthrie's room. He turned the knob and found it unlocked, which made his hopes dim even further. He was almost afraid of what he would see as he pushed open the door. For a split second, it appeared that everything was fine. Dr. Hill was standing in the middle of the room, leaning toward Stephanie, who sat in the chair she had barely moved from for several days, her eyes closed, her arms outstretched. An echo hung in the air, as though Dr. Hill had just asked a question that awaited an answer. Just as Vic was about to speak and announce his presence, Stephanie's eyes opened and fixed on the doctor's. Her lips parted with a soft plip. Vic darted into the room, knowing what she was about to say, but for some reason time seemed to have slowed, the way it does in dreams. Stephanie seemed very far away, her mouth opening like a tiny black O. "Lepidoptera," she said, and then her entire frame collapsed, and blood began to ooze from her nose and mouth. As Vic watched, she crumpled to the floor, her eyes already beginning to glaze over, the single word she had spoken humming around the enclosed space like a hell-bent mosquito. Dr. Hill was clapping her hands, obviously trying to awaken a patient that would wake no more. She still had not noticed Vic at all. She moved towards Stephanie. And then Vic felt it, that word the woman had whispered, tunneling into his brain like an earthworm through the loam, lodging in the deepest part of him. He could feel it radiating outward from this command center, infecting his flesh, his entire molecular structure. He could feel it squirming within him, using him for its own devilish purposes, waiting for the moment when it would unleash itself upon the unwary, making of him an unwitting carrier, accomplice, slaughterer. Dr. Hill finally turned and saw him standing there, and just before his brain began its inevitable withdrawal into its cocoon, he managed to lock gazes with her. She had fallen to her knees next to the corpse of her patient, clearly suffering the same appalling fate as he. Vic tried to smile at her, if only to show that they were now joined in their shared contagion, but he couldn't quite do it. At last, he felt his body falling, and his thin veneer of rationality dissolved completely, his thumping heart keeping time with the ticking beat of the metronome.